Hello and welcome back to the Future Building Podcast. I'm Matthew Aitchison and I'm Professor at Monash University and CEO of Building 4.0 CRC, a cooperative R&D hub for the building industry. We're back this time for another essay on a topic that I've been thinking about for quite some time, 1 year in fact. As ever, opinions expressed on this podcast are my own and do not represent those of Monash University or Building 4.0 CRC. The Future Building Podcast is proudly sponsored by Building 4.0 CRC. Abundance in housing, 1 year later. It seems hard to believe that it's been 1 year already since the blockbuster book of 2025 was published. Of course, I'm talking about Abundance by Derek Thompson and Ezra Klein, which was released in March 2025. As an author, it's hard to imagine a book landing better. Right message at the right moment, with uptake and nods from all the right places. Given this stellar reception and the splash it made in public debates, I wanted to revisit the book and the moment that some were calling and still are, the abundance agenda. In this essay, I'd like to talk about what has happened since the book's release and explore the main lines of its popular uptake, with a particular focus on housing. I also want to revisit some of the arguments that Abundance made that didn't receive much attention the first time around, but which I think are even more important now than perhaps back in March 2025. I should also be clear in pointing out that I'm not trying to cover the book's entire message or its wider global reception. Abundance is a book about so much more than just housing. It's about politics, government, and policy. It's about the kind of lives we have and the kind of lives we could have. And housing is just one part of the book's wider scope. If you haven't read the book, don't worry, we've got you. Let's start with a summary. The shortest summary comes from Thompson and Klein themselves. The book, the authors state, is dedicated to a simple idea. To have the future we want, we need to build and invent more of what we need. That's it. That's the thesis. Now, that summary is perhaps so short that it was probably too short, so let's go a layer deeper. I see the book making the case that the world would be a better place if certain things that are currently scarce were more abundant. This might include life-saving medical treatments and drugs, virtuous energy sources, productivity-improving transport infrastructure, and of course, and most important for this conversation, abundant housing. But despite the best of intentions, somehow we've made it difficult to make all of these things abundant. Furthermore, we've made it especially difficult to make these things abundant in the advanced economies of Western democratic societies. The authors are based in the US, and so this insight goes a layer deeper to say that this phenomenon is particularly apparent in liberal states, which means democratically governed or blue states in the USA. Now, instead of making things that would make life better for people, abundance argues our societies have done the opposite. We have made it the default to make life as hard as possible for those who wish to bring these things into the world. Hard to make infrastructure like high-speed rail. Hard to make the new energy infrastructure required to decarbonize our economies. Hard to make the housing for our growing populations. Hard to invent and distribute life-saving medicines or treatments. And hard to do the R&D that could invent new solutions for any of these areas. The bulk of the book is dedicated to examples and case studies that show, on the one hand, how bad things have become, and on the other hand, what might be done to turn this situation around. At this point, I should also confess that I'm a huge fan of this book. That would probably disqualify me from providing the kind of unbiased review required in academic circles, but this is a podcast, so I can happily ignore those rules. When Abundance was published, I quickly downloaded it and read it straight away. I felt that I already knew quite a bit about it before it was released because there'd been so much fanfare and so many interviews and stories in the media in the lead up to its release. As someone who has studied similar problems to Thompson and Klein, I felt a real kinship with many of the messages in the book. Why is it so hard to build more? How did liberalism, as they term it, become the politics of blocking and NIMBYism? And why can't well-meaning people working across government and industry with the best of intentions solve our most pressing problems? So, as the book then entered the mainstream of public debate, I watched and read with some hope that the abundance agenda might be a moment where the tide could turn towards a liberalism that builds, as the authors called it. And turn it did, particularly in relation to housing and construction more generally. Abundance started popping up across the media and politics. Ministers in my home country of Australia delivered long speeches on it. At a press conference, our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, was asked by a journalist if he'd read it. At that point, he had not. And that was just in Australia. But perhaps it was my fandom and agreement with the book's core message that then caused me to scratch my head as I saw, slowly at first, but then more rapidly, the outline of the book's popular reception starting to take shape. In the first 3 months or so, if you squinted, you could see the letters forming into words. They spelled red tape. It appears the big message that many took from abundance was that scarcity in infrastructure or housing, for example, can largely be traced to red tape, regulatory overreach, complex and in some cases downright ridiculous regulatory burden. The book's case studies of well-meaning but ultimately Kafkaesque bureaucratic overreach were both sad and shocking. And I would say they landed some of the heaviest hits of the book. Perhaps that part of the book's message was delivered too well, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. The message of regulatory overreach found fertile ground around the world, particularly when that ground happened to be located in the middle of a housing crisis. From the middle of 2025, a public debate took flight around our new public enemy, number one. Red tape. Onlookers in this debate could be forgiven for thinking that all that really needed to be done was to wipe the regulatory slate clean to get housing back on track. Free at last, we heard exclamations abound. Not so fast, I would say. As the popular reception and public opinion on abundance settled around issues of overregulation and red tape, I found this whole thing strange, to say the least. It was strange because it was a very, very selective view of the book, and it overshadowed some of the other key arguments that I think Thompson and Klein were trying to make. Would it shock you if I said that about a quarter of the book's ink is devoted to another topic entirely? One that received little attention, overshadowed, you might say, by the tangled, hulking mass of codes, regulations, and environmental protection laws that Thompson and Klein tell us are choking modern democratic societies. If you haven't guessed it already, that topic is innovation. In my reading, abundance is clearly and equally a plea for innovation. If you recall Thompson and Klein's short summary earlier, it's not only about building, it's about inventing as well. The authors start the book with a vision from the future, where the big problems have all been solved and life is better for our future citizens. There's energy, mobility, healthcare, and housing. All the advances in technology that this vision points to can be traced back to innovation, and Thompson and Klein are explicit in pointing this out in their book, from start to finish. The responsibility for the improvements to people's lives that the authors wish to see rests with companies and governments working together in harmony and learning to innovate again together. Of course, I am biased towards innovation, and I do not wish to suggest for a minute that red tape is not a problem in our industry or that the kinds of regulatory reforms that are both cited in the book or that have arisen subsequent to its publication are not required. That's not my point at all. Instead, the point to make here is that regulation is just one part of the puzzle and that other solutions are necessary. Sadly, I also feel that the overestimation of the role of regulation in preventing housing supply fits into a familiar package that has existed in public debates for decades. It draws on the deep-seated animus towards wasteful government processes. The things that Thompson and Klein reveal about the burdensome path to high-speed rail or building a house for those in need fill us with contempt. These strong feelings mean that in a competition between getting people excited about innovation or getting them riled up about red tape insanity, red tape is bound to win every time. And that's what I meant when I implied earlier that Thompson and Klein's argument had been perhaps made too well. And I wish it weren't so. I wish that innovation didn't have to lose that competition for attention every time. I may not like it, but I think I understand how innovation got overshadowed by regulation. Innovation is hard. It costs money. It involves risk-taking. It takes a long time. It requires leadership. But as I've pointed out in earlier essays, I can't see a road to higher productivity in building or abundance in housing that does not pass through innovation. When I read abundance, I think that it is proposing a new alignment between government and private industry to catalyze the kinds of innovation required to give us abundance in our economy, in housing, healthcare, or infrastructure. To carry out such a transformation, this does and always will require more than cutting red tape. And Thompson and Klein know this. To understand some aspects of abundance better, particularly in relation to the interaction between innovation and the role of government, I went back to revisit another bestseller published 12 years earlier, a book that I think could be seen as part of the inspiration for abundance. The book I speak of is Mariana Mazzucato's The Entrepreneurial State, which was first published in 2013. As the title of the book suggests, it proposes a more entrepreneurial role for the state. As Mazzucato summarizes, it's not about the big state or the small state, it's about the smart state. Mazzucato's mission is, in part, to turn the perception on its head that private industry is dynamic, inventive, and bold, whereas governments are slow, risk-averse, and uninventive. This was a view held broadly at the time, probably still is, a scenario where private companies do the innovation and governments, well, they do the taxing. And it also explains the book's subtitle, Debunking Public versus Private Sector Myths. Mazzucato proposed that governments could and should play a part in solving the big problems of the day, not by controlling markets as authoritarian states would seek to do, but by shaping them, particularly those markets that are failing. Not only did Mazzucato suggest that governments should do this, but that they have a long history of doing this. And her book provides examples from life-saving drugs to essential technologies that show this well-worn path of governments taking the lead. Although she only mentions housing obliquely in a footnote, it's hard to think of a better example today for a failing market that could use some intervention than housing. Mazzucato's premise is wider than Thompson and Klein's on this subject. She bemoans the now customary route of innovators who conveniently forget how the companies they founded were built on top of technologies that originated in publicly funded programs. As she elegantly describes the unfortunate consequences of modern capitalism, where it is the risks that are socialized and the rewards that are privatized. I love that quote, the risks that are socialized and the rewards that are privatized. Her book is full of many of the same examples in abundance that show how government-seeded investments in innovation that have paid big commercial and societal dividends. Abundance and the entrepreneurial state have a lot of common ground. Both books agree that government needs to play a bigger role and a more generative role in innovation. And both books also point principally to governments to turn this status quo around. It is more than coincidental, then, that both books also cite the exact words and the same authority in the shape of John Maynard Keynes and his famous book, The End of Laissez-Faire from 1926, which just happens to have a handy quote to hammer home the point. And I quote, "The important thing for government is not to do things which individuals are already doing and do them a little better or a little worse, but to do those things which at present are not done at all." Keynes wasn't, but could easily have been speaking of housing innovation. Coming back to abundance, perhaps another of the reasons that the book's reception on housing and construction matters has centered so much on red tape is because there actually wasn't that much in it on housing innovation. Despite housing being one of, if not the most major case studies in the book, Thompson and Klein are actually pretty thin on what real housing innovation could look like. The treatment of the subject appears to start and stop with the words prefab and modular. In rereading Abundance 1 year later, I found myself wanting the book to go further in proposing new ways of doing things, to show more examples of what could be done to solve the crisis beyond cutting red tape. For all its erudition, the book plays some common tropes around housing innovation. And this is something that I've noticed as well in Ezra Klein's podcast when housing matters are discussed there, as they were most recently in an interview with the Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, where they discuss, among many other things, the housing crisis and the role that prefab or modular could play in late 2025. I have a strong suspicion that for Thompson and Klein, as for so many public debates, the terms prefab and modular are symbolic claims to innovation, the same way that prefab is often used as a simple synonym for building innovation. But here's the problem. Prefab is not a new idea. In fact, it's very old. With the right conditions, it has proved very effective in some countries, and Klein points out in his Newsom interview that 80% of housing in Sweden, for example, is modular. But there is little discussion of why Sweden's successes have not spread to other countries. In fact, I have a slide in one of my lectures that says, "If it's such a good idea, why don't we have it already?" And sadly, these issues are often not explored in popular media, and they are also absent from Abundance. The answers to these questions are complex and take time to unpack, but they are ultimately explainable. And it was such an explanation that I wanted to read more about. But more than just a simple omission or something that fell outside the scope of the book, I think the absence of a wider view of building innovation is actually a bigger tell. Why does the innovation conversation often stop at prefab? I want to go a little deeper here because I think I'm onto something that reaches beyond abundance and into wider perceptions in society and the wider mindset of the building industry at large. Thompson and Klein's treatments of the curious case of falling productivity in the building sector are a good point in case where we will start. In the chapter titled Build, Thompson and Klein rhetorically scratch their heads about construction productivity. They called the section the construction puzzle. And I quote, "Think of the technology we have today that we didn't have in the 1970s. The new generations of power tools and computer modeling and teleconferencing and advanced machinery and prefab materials and global shipping. You'd think we could build so much more, so much faster, for so much less money than in the past. But we can't, or at least we don't." End of quote. With recourse to some of the productivity literature, the authors then embark on an excursion to find out why construction productivity, since about 1970, has lagged behind the rest of the economy. Was it underinvestment? Poor measurement? Is it overregulation? But they find no correlation between these things. So the authors go deeper yet into political science and economics. Why is it that democracies, specifically, have problems building at scale these days? China can build high-speed rail, but California can't. The authority they cite here is a well-known book from 1982 entitled The Rise and Decline of Nations by Mancur Olson. Olson's thesis, they summarize, suggests that countries who have become affluent and who have focused on improving social standards and values, such as work site safety, for example, Also accept lower productivity along with, and in parallel to, a kind of institutional sclerosis that Olson proposed had afflicted these democratic societies. In summarizing Olson, Thompson and Klein agree with him in stating that, and I'm quoting here, affluence is a gift that comes with costs, and these costs concentrate in the areas of the economy in which the number of groups that have to be consulted mounts. From this perspective, the authors say, the productivity woes in the construction industry don't seem so puzzling. End of quote. Moving to economics and the business of house building, they ask if falling productivity could also be attributed to the structure of the industry that builds those houses, namely its fragmentation and dominance by small players. The answer, somewhat unrewardingly, is that home building is a highly localized industry, and you guessed it, it's the local part of localized that adds the complexity, nuance, and regulatory burden that throttles many of these companies' growth and impedes them from scaling beyond their local patches. So, in summary, back to regulation again. Now, I accept that for our podcast, this is all pretty heady stuff, so let's pause for a moment and take stock. Thompson and Klein are well aware of the problems of declining construction productivity and its impact on cost. But with recourse to some of the excellent literature on the topic, and a fairly erudite reading of it must be said, they also really don't have a remedy. Looking at an earlier op-ed from Klein published in the New York Times in February 2023, that is 2 years before Abundance is printed, that piece was aptly titled, "The Story Construction Tells About America's Economy is Disturbing." Great title. And in that piece, Klein is a bit more forthright in his assessment, and he asks, "How do we get construction productivity rising again?" The answer, and this is the part where he's being a bit more forthright, I have no idea. So back in 2023, there were no solutions on the table, but a very clear and helpful statement of the problem. And in that piece, Klein goes on to say, many of the problems America faces, from decarbonisation to affordable housing, would be a lot easier to solve if we were getting better at building rather than worse. End of quote. So, why aren't the US and other countries, to use Klein's words, getting better at building? I have to say, I find this all very frustrating, because isn't the answer right in front of Thompson and Klein? Isn't the answer one of the co-theses of their blockbuster book? Couldn't the industry's poor record on productivity be traced to the fact that the industry has forgotten, and in some cases never knew, how to innovate? And that this lack of innovation, indeed the dereliction of innovation by government and the sector, has only been exacerbated by a thick permafrost of regulation applied on top. Maybe the fact that Abundance's popular reception on all matters building has centered around red tape and overregulation is actually not a misreading of the book, but a direct outcome of the fact that the authors themselves failed to consider innovation deeply as it applies to housing. This omission is all the more perplexing, at least in my reading, because in another chapter they propose a framework precisely for this purpose. They call it the bottleneck detective. In the author's words, this is where government, representing, and I'm quoting here, a new kind of entrepreneurial state, end of quote, can look for opportunities to fix things. Echoing back to the earlier quote from Keynes, the authors state that, and I'm quoting again, being a bottleneck detective isn't just about removing things that don't work. Sometimes it's about creating entirely new programs that don't exist but should. End of quote. Now, before we move along here in this piece, I want to make one more point. I intimated earlier that the omission of a deeper discussion of what innovation in housing might look like pointed to a wider cultural issue. I think that issue needs to be called by its name. I think that it is very hard for futurists and thinkers and pundits alike to imagine the future of building. And Thompson and Klein's omission of such a view in their great book is really just a continuation of this pre-existing pattern. It's a bigger topic to explore, but I think that it's both weird and also safe to say, on the other hand, that there is no clear vision or template in the public view for how the future of building, or housing for that matter, will look. Indulge me, if you will, in a short exercise. Think about the innovation horizons for just a couple of the major sectors we hear about every day: energy, healthcare, mobility, information technology, communications. I think I could list two or three inventions for each of these areas that are likely to be forthcoming in the next 5 years. Furthermore, I feel I could almost guess the innovation roadmap of every major aerospace or automotive company active in the global markets today, not because I'm some kind of auto or aero enthusiast, but because these ideas have made it into popular culture. We read about them every day in the media. What about our building and development companies? What's on their roadmaps? If, and this is a big if, there is an image in the public consciousness about the future of building, it's usually something like 3D printing or robotics. But the future of building, at least the near future, I would posit, is not the kind of future of flying cars and hoverboards. It's much more prosaic. I think it's much more rooted in the problems and barriers of the present. As I have said previously, it's not an ideas problem per se, but an implementation problem. I think the absence of a vision for the future in building is a strange feature of our industry, and I also think that it explains the recourse in abundance to modular and green cement as the only two ideas cited around innovation. The absence of clear ideas about housing innovation in abundance is really just a reflection of the broader absence of ideas in the mainstream consciousness. As we move to wrap up now, a moment of self-loathing, if you will permit. And I say that tongue in cheek. It's such an academic thing to do, to take a great book like Abundance that has enjoyed such great success, but then split some hairs and say it would have been better if only the authors had dot 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 fill in the blank. So I asked myself a really self-indulgent question. What could Thompson and Klein have written about building innovation that would have scratched my itch and taken that part of the book out of the realm of problem admiration? Perhaps it's not as self-indulgent as it first seems, because if, as Abundance suggests, we are going to upend the status quo, and as our others have framed it more bluntly, build, baby, build, perhaps we need to scratch a little deeper under the surface. Perhaps we should be asking why building and housing hasn't been able to self-generate the innovation required to meet its mission. Perhaps we could try to better understand what options are out there that could help us build and invent more of what we need, to quote Thompson and Klein back to them. So the following is a kind of cheat sheet, if you will, of just four things that I thought of that Thompson and Klein could have examined in a bit more detail. Firstly, it could have carried a wider examination of the lack of innovation and the lack of innovation culture in building and housing. And why has it such low investment in R&D? Why, for example, is tech adoption so low in our industry? Secondly, it could have included a treatment of the structure and business of building, a bit further than what we were talking about before, specifically its fragmentation, low margins, and antiquated business models and value chains. All these things make running a development or building company a very risky business. Thirdly, I would have liked to have seen a deeper understanding of sector-specific challenges. For example, an acknowledgement that buildings are mostly one-offs. They're very big, they're very expensive, and they're very risky. A description of houses as artifacts, perhaps, that are highly contingent and localized, and therefore highly resistant to commoditization or industrialization, unlike other consumer products that we're all familiar with. And finally, I would have loved to get Thompson and Klein's view of what McKinsey call innovation horizons, namely, what kinds of innovation in building or housing may be appropriate in the near term versus the long term, or whether it's better to start with software versus the hardware of building, new materials or processes, new business models or workforce renewal, or even at what scale such innovation might occur, ranging from the very small to the very large. The list I've just put to you here is certainly not exhaustive, but it would have been a start. Meaningful innovation in building requires us to address these issues if we are to have any chance of changing things for the better. These are just a few of the points that would have scratched my itch, and who knows, they might just have planted a flag for a wider discussion around strategies to boost housing production through innovation. Moving to close now, if the impression has taken shape that I'm being harsh or critical of abundance, this is really wrong. I am a huge fan. But as I said earlier, it's precisely because of my fandom and also because of the size of the platform and the unique nature of the coalition that abundance has achieved that the missed opportunity to explain to an audience not normally interested in building housing or innovation what has actually been holding things back strikes me as a big missed opportunity. Abundance, it needs to be said again, is a book about many more things than just housing. And some of you will no doubt say that it is framed as a popular book about politics, government, and policy, and that it was never going to be an in-depth coverage of all areas. To this, I would say there wasn't too much that was missing, just a little. And while we're on that point, I for one believe in the role of popular books in driving public debate and awareness in our industry, more and in some cases much more than I do, frankly, the hundreds of academic papers and reports which are published every year that no policymaker will ever likely read. I think more than anything, certainly more than exercising my own hobby horses, in this essay I've tried to draw attention to the key role that abundance has played in public debates over the last year. One year on, I think we need to be clear in tempering a popular reception that sees a new quick fix in cutting red tape and regulatory burden. The risky delusion I see springing up all over the place is that somehow it might be possible to simply deregulate our way to heaven. To those who have taken this message and run with it, I would say cutting red tape will never be enough. I would also like to add a final remark from the trenches, as it were. Innovation is hard, full stop. Innovating in the building industry is even harder. If there were a simple unlock we could make, the housing crisis would already be solved. But having accepted this fact, there is no way around innovation, and there will be no abundant future of housing without the hard work of innovation or without industry and government working together to unblock the dysfunctions of the market and create a new, more productive, and just industry in its place. This is not an easy task, and in this, I agree wholeheartedly with Thompson and Klein. It's fitting to close with a quote from the book that sums up the challenge before us. Scientific progress, the authors tell us, is a blessing that comes with a curse. The unsolved problems are typically harder than the solved ones. Many thanks for joining us on the podcast today. If you like what you heard, I'd urge you to subscribe. And I also want to thank our editor, Dr. Sarah Breen Lovett, and Michael Hogg for the theme music. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. One final message before we end. 2 days after I recorded this essay, I checked my feed for new podcasts and was surprised to find one from the Ezra Klein Show. It was titled, What We Got Right and Wrong in Abundance. On that podcast, Ezra Klein was joined by his co-author, Derek Thompson, and another author, Mark Dunkelman, who'd published a similar book at a similar time. All three went through in conversation to see what had happened since the publications of their respective books, and perhaps more importantly, what had not happened. Having now had the opportunity to listen to that episode, and if I could go back in time, I think I may have changed one or two things in hindsight, but in the main, I think that the points that I make in this podcast still stand in relation to housing matters. I just wanted to mention this because for those of you who do go on and listen to the Ezra Klein Show, I wanted to be clear that I wrote my version before I had heard Thompson and Klein give their report on their 1-year anniversary on the publication of Abundance.